could start with a brief review of what we talked about yesterday. We're dealing with the fourth frame of reference, which is part of the practice of right mindfulness. Suffering, dukkha here can also be translated as stress. We're talking specifically about your internal experience of suffering. We're not talking about misfortunes outside. It's something you feel totally inwardly. Nobody else can see your suffering or can feel it. You feel it very much so. And the approach, the Buddha's approach, is to not only deal with this as an internal problem, but also to solve it from the inside. This is important because he's not saying that you're just a bunch of chemical processes and that what your awareness is just a byproduct of chemical or physical processes. You basically shape your life from the inside already. And so a lot of the suffering comes from the way you shape your life with a lack of skill or with a lack of knowledge. The path to the end of suffering is learning how to do these internal processes in a skillful way with knowledge. So you're not going to solve the problem by changing the chemistry of your body, and you're not going to solve the problem by saying, okay, we've got to go out and change society before you're going to find some happiness. Work for the problem from within. Now, it's not that we don't go out and try to help people, but that's part of our practice. But the real problem is something inward that each person has to solve for him or herself. The role of mindfulness here deals with the fact that, as the Buddha said, you know, the mind is shaping its experience. It's a process he calls fabrication. The Pali word is sankhara. We fabricate our experience in three ways. Bodily, we fabricate it through the breath. Verbally, he says, we fabricate it through the way we talk to ourselves. The technical terms here are directed thought and evaluation. Now, if you've ever read any instructions on jhana, that should ring a bell. That's actually part of the first step in jhana, is how you're talking to yourself about getting your mind to settle down. That's also called verbal fabrication. We're doing it all the time, whether in jhana or out of jhana. And then the third type of fabrication is mental, and perceptions and feelings. We have perceptions here, the ways we label things. They can either be visual labels or just a word that we assign to something, that we name it. And we do these things all the time, and because we're doing them without much awareness, they can lead to suffering very easily. What we're trying to do as we develop the path is to shape our experience in a more skillful way. Be conscious about how we're breathing, be conscious about how we're talking to ourselves. When it's unskillful, what can we do to change? Be conscious about the perceptions we're holding in mind. I'll give you an example. When you're deciding that you're going to pass judgment on somebody, the underlying perception is you're up there on a throne. And you're pointing your finger again, this person is, you know, has done this or done that, and you're coming from a position of power and authority. And you have to ask yourself, am I in that position where I'm totally immune to whatever judgment I pass? The image the Buddha has you hold in mind is something that's been treating you poorly is to look for their good qualities. And the image you have you hold in mind is of someone who's going through a desert, hot, trembling with thirst. And you come across a little pool of water in a cow's footprint. Now you know if you bend over and scoop it up with your hand, you're going to muddy the water. So what do you do? You have to bend over even further and slurp it up. Now if someone were to come along and take a picture of you at that point, it's not a picture you'd like to have out on Facebook. Right? But you say, I don't care because I need that water. In the same way, you need the other person's goodness. He says, look at the other person, look for the other person's goodness, because you need the other person's goodness to help nourish your own. If you're living in a world where all you can see are horrible people, it gets very, very hard to act with people in a skillful way, with goodwill. I don't know if I told you this before about this cartoon I saw in the New Yorker one time. There was two lady poodles sitting at a bar. You knew they were ladies because they had lipstick. And one of them was saying to the other, they're all sons of bitches. Now, if they're all sons of bitches, what does that make you? So you can't have that perception in mind. You've got to look at the world with perceptions that actually are nourishing for your own goodwill, nourishing for your own skillfulness. This is one of the reasons why the Buddha uses so many analogies and images in his teaching, is trying to give you something to hold in mind. You know, you've probably heard the analogy of the person who's being pinned down by other people and they're sawing off his limbs. And the Buddha says, suppose bandits were to savagely pin you down and saw off your limbs with a two-handled saw. If you let any ill will for those bandits come into your mind, you would not be following my teaching. Okay, now, you know, if somebody in your family yells at you, you remind yourself, is this as bad as being pinned down with a two-handled, you know, my bandits? You say, no, it's not quite so bad. I can stand this. So that's one of the ways you use perceptions in order to shape your mind in a skillful direction. Now, when we're shaping things in our experience, and the process of shaping goes very deep. I mean, even before sensory contact, we have predispositions to thinking about certain things, focusing on certain things, looking at things in a certain way, shaping it in a certain way. And the way we do that is, one, based on our memory of things from the past, based on our perception of what we see in the present moment, and based on our intentions for the future. All three time frames are involved. And so when we're developing mindfulness, we also develop three qualities that deal with all three time frames. Mindfulness itself is, contrary to what is taught in the popular press, mindfulness itself is a factor of memory. You're keeping something in mind. In this particular case, you're trying to keep in mind, if you're working on the path, keeping in mind all the various instructions, all the various lessons you've learned from practicing as to what and what doesn't work. Alertness is what deals with the present moment. In other words, you alert to what you're doing and the results of what you're doing. And then finally, ardency is the quality that wants to do all this well. Now that relates both to the present moment and into the future. You're doing this well, so you get good at results now and results that will do, you know, serve you well into the future. So the practice of right mindfulness covers all three time periods. Because we're developing all three qualities, mindfulness, ardency, and alertness. Now in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha talks primarily about just one aspect of what are you trying to keep in mind. As we pointed out yesterday, when he sets out the full formula for the establishment of mindfulness, and then he only focuses on answering questions about one part of the formula. Now, what does it mean to stay focused on something? And it gives you a whole range of things you should be focused on. Now the question of how does ardency fit in, how does alertness fit in this phrase that he has, putting aside grief and stress with reference to the world, that doesn't get answered in that sutta. And for that reason, this is why many people think, well, there's nothing you have to do, just be aware of things coming as they arise. But he's just saying, here's an explanation of this one part of the formula. For the rest of the formula, we look in different parts of the canon. You know, when you're dealing with hindrances, okay, what do you do, or how do you, they're not something you just allow to come and go as they want. You want to see why they come, you see why they go, so that you can actually get rid of them. Same with the factors for waking. These are good things, so you want to understand how they come and how they go, so that you can nurture them and increase them and maintain them. When you're focused on the six sense media, that's primarily a practice for restraint of the senses. So you see any way that you're fettering yourself, any desire or passion that arises, either desire or passion for liking or desire or passion for disliking, you look at, well, what can I do to put an end to that? And that basically comes down to, when you're looking, one, who's doing the looking? Are you doing the looking, or is your greed doing the looking? Or is your anger doing the looking? What's causing you to look or listen in the first place? And then when you look or listen in that way, what happens to the mind? What kind of good or bad qualities get nurtured by that? If they're bad qualities, what are you going to do to stop it? Are you going to look at things or listen to things in a different way? So these are all providing a framework that will then give us directions on what you do. What's the proper approach? So in this fourth frame of reference, there aren't just those topics. There are the six sense media, there are the five front hindrances, there are the seven factors for awakening. Those are the topics we covered yesterday. Today we're going to go into the Four Noble Truths and the five aggregates, five clinging aggregates. This is the six sense media, a good framework to keep in mind as you're going through the day. So that when someone says something to you, you can just keep it right there. And the sound has come at the ear. Someone in the family is yelling at you. Someone at work is yelling at you. It's okay, there's a sound at the ear. And you don't let it go into a, why are they yelling at me? Just kind of keep it there at that process, at that level. And then it's a lot easier to step out of the line of fire so you can actually look at what needs to be done, what needs to be said in response. So the five hindrances, there are things that you want to get rid of in the course of your concentration, trying to get the mind to settle down. The seven factors for waking are things that you want to develop to get the mind to settle down. Now all these come under the framework of the Four Noble Truths. Because the Four Noble Truths have their duties. You try to comprehend suffering as fast, you try to abandon the cause, you try to realize the cessation so that you then develop the path. Four different things, and each with a different duty. So that you can know how to deal with a particular situation as it comes up. But before we go into that, I'm going to stop and ask if there are any questions based on yesterday's discussion. Things that were left over that you started thinking about last night. Was nobody thinking last night?
About doubt, the fifth of the hindrances, and even just for to start, it's your understanding, given that that's, you know, what's recommended, considering skillful, unskillful, and so on. It's doubt about or doubt of what?
Doubt about the teaching, basically. Did the Buddha really know what he's talking about? One. Secondly, doubt about, am I capable of doing this? Those are the two debilitating ones.
And it's the second one. Would you speak more about that one? Because I think that's the one that grabs me at times.
Okay. The Buddha has you reflect on the people who've done this path in the past. You read some of the Tarigata and the Theravada. They were pretty miserable. I mean, there was this one guy who was thinking of committing suicide seven times. You say, at least I haven't been there. Or if I have, I'm out. And John Munn used to talk on this topic quite a lot because most of his students were peasants from northeastern Thailand. Now, northeastern Thailand is the poorest part of the country, and the peasants there were the most downtrodden bunch in the country. And he said, and you know, those are the people that society was basically looking down on, and they many times had picked up that attitude themselves. And he was constantly saying, no, look, what do you need in order to practice? You need a body. And you need a mind, and you need not to be crazy. Now you're there. So you've got what it takes. Now the question of whether it's going to happen quickly or slowly, that's another matter. And today we'll be getting into the issue of rebirth, to take that into consideration. Maybe not this time around, but at least I'll head in the right direction. Maybe we'll finish the path this time, but at least I'll head in the right direction. And that's a good thing to be doing. But as for your doubts about whether you get the mind to settle down, say, at least I've got this breath. Okay, let's leave this breath. Okay, now there's this breath, okay? Three breaths in a row, okay? And after a while, it gets more and more and more. So that's one way down with it. Yes?
Yesterday, Ajahn, you were giving a set of opposites after talking about unattractiveness. Mm-hmm. So healthy, positive, healthy, negative, unhealthy, positive, unhealthy, negative. Mm-hmm. And I got lost in some of those examples. So I was wondering if you could just give a brief.
Okay, your body image. Healthy, positive. I've got a body that I can do all kinds of good things with. Unhealthy, positive. I'm really good looking. Because that sets you up for all kinds of problems. Unhealthy, negative. I'm ugly and everybody else is beautiful. Healthy, negative. We're all ugly. Boil it down to the simplest terms.
Right view.
Yeah, we're going to go into that.
You are, okay.
Yes.
I looked at the list of 10 fetters last night, and I see that the hindrances are also listed in that list, but I know that there are different ideas. Could you talk about what's the
difference? Well, because the hindrance is something that you can kind of get rid of long enough to get the mind to concentration. And that quality gets, those qualities get totally cut through only with certain levels of the noble path. So for the sake of getting your mind into concentration, you wouldn't have to put it at bay. Like the doubt or the passion or whatever. There will come a point, though, when you're able to cut through that, and that's not going to be a problem ever again. Now, it's interesting that of the four stages of awakening, the one at which you have totally perfected concentration is non-return. That's the third or the fourth stage, four stages. Because at that point, you've overcome sensual passion totally. And prior to that, you'd also overcome doubt. And those are the two big ones. Because together with passion also goes irritation. So that's your basis for ill will is gone. So your concentration will never be totally perfected until you're a non-returner. Which is at least I can work on it in the meantime. So when talking about hindrances, we're talking about things we're getting out of the way temporarily. But there are fetters that actually cause rebirth if we don't cut them through. And so eventually you have to get to the point in the practice where you use discernment that will cut through these things. And then they're gone.
Someone described the fetters as a habit, thought pattern.
They are.
A loop?
Well, they can be a loop. I mean, they bring you back. And there, all of these things we're talking about here are habits of the mind. When we talk about the mind holding on to things, as I said yesterday, you don't have a hand up there that's grasping onto something, but you do have a habit that keeps coming back to things. And the habit there is, we'll get into the issue of feeding. These are things that the mind feeds on again and again and again. Going back to. And that's what you'll get learned how to cut, that habit of going back to these things. Yes?
I'd like to understand a little more about concentration, because, for instance, the seventh factor of awakening, so if you are mindful, you are a kind of concentration permanent of awareness. But then I understand the joy or the energy that we could get, but then for me, I understand that concentration is kind of coming back to mindfulness. Is there a big difference?
Okay, there's no big difference between concentration and mindfulness. It's simply that the more established your mindfulness is, the more you get into concentration. And the Buddha never taught them as two separate processes. When you are with your mindfulness and it's well established, that's the first jhana. You're there. If you're doing it right, and it really is well established. So, two parts of the same thing. And then mindfulness itself doesn't get purified into the higher levels of jhana. So the two go together.
Can you just elaborate a little bit about the difference between kind of a healthy delight in life and just like lust and passion and lust in life and passion in life as differentiated between healthy and unhealthy. Like you were talking about flowers yesterday as opposed to wanting a car and wanting flowers and those subtle differences. And
okay, it's hard to generalize, but you're asking basically what you would look at. am I so attached to this particular thing that, you know, I can't think of myself not feeding on it, or that I can't let go of feeding on it? Because then you got a problem.
Right.
I mean, you can make that kind of problem out of flowers. You know? Get really, really obsessed.
So if you get attached to it and you're clinging to it, you have to have it. But if it's just kind of coming forth and you have a delight, that's okay.
Yeah. Well, there's an image that comes about, well, you know, what are you finding delight in life? And one of the things that you should be finding delight is, I'm going to do this skillfully. I'm going to enjoy being skillful by the way I'm around other people, by the way I do it my own mind. And there's a joy that comes with that, that you've developed a skill and you've mastered it, and you're actually out there, your interactions with other people are not just fun, but you're actually good for everybody.
Okay.
That's a part of the life.
Okay. It has to do with your intention.
It has to do with your intention and the kind of joy you're taking out of it.
Okay.
Yes?
I was wondering if you could talk about tools for dealing with anxiety as a hindrance, because I have such severe anxiety, it's like hard to leave the house and I'm afraid to talk to people, and so yeah, any kind of tools to help stay present and like not fabricate like nightmares out of reality, basically.
Okay, well the first thing is to go outside the house for 5 minutes and come back in and say, that wasn't so bad. And then, well, let's try 10 minutes. And then just sort of push yourself a little bit, and then they come back and say, okay, that wasn't as bad as I was afraid of. That is part of me that's thinking all these anxious thoughts. Learn to see that as just one member of your committee in the mind, and there are other members as well. So it's not just my fear, but there is a voice of fear inside me. And see if you can identify, where did I pick this up? Whose voice am I carrying around? And ask yourself, does this voice really mean me well?
Mm-hmm.
And John Lee has a great image. He says, you don't know, maybe there's some little worms going through your blood system. And they had some issues from you from a past lifetime. So every time they go through your brain, they go... The other problem with anxiety, of course, is your physical reaction. And this is where you can use the breath to calm yourself down. It's okay, there may be this knot of tension here, or this feeling in the pit of my stomach, but how about the rest of my body? Can I get the rest of my body relaxed? And then once the rest of the body's relaxed, can I kind of allow that relaxation to go in here? Because what's happened is the anxiety has hijacked your breath, and through the breath it's doing weird things to your body. This is what we talk about, physical fabrication. It's okay, I can consciously breathe in a way that is not being taken over by the anxiety. And allow that sense of healthy breath energy to come and kind of permeate the feeling there. And then as for the nightmares, ask yourself the question we had up yesterday, that, you know, what if the opposite is true? What if a disaster is not gonna happen? So get yourself out of that loop.
Back in the Buddha's day, was this the kind of anxiety he was thinking of when you talk at the hindrance of restlessness and anxiety? Excuse me. Is that what he was referring to, a kind of social anxiety, that deep fear that many people in Western society today can experience?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we have the fears that come with our modern media. We forget about the anxiety that comes from living in a village where everybody's known you all your lifetime. And everybody can remember what you did when you were young and stupid. There is that social anxiety. I mean, I used to think, gee, a big extended family, wouldn't that be great? And then I talked to people who lived in a big extended family. They said, everybody wants to tell you what to do all the time.
Right?
And if they can't tell you what to do, then they'll drag up memories of what you did when you were younger, the stupid things. So there's a lot of anxiety in every human society. It's just, I think we tend to focus on different objects. But the human ability to generate anxiety over little things is a constant. Because it doesn't take much in your environment to spark these things. I was reading a book years back about an experiment they did with a pigeon. And first they put the pigeon in a box, the male pigeon in a box with a female pigeon, and clocked him to see how long it would take him to do his mating dance. Then they took the female pigeon out, put a male pigeon in, clocked him. And it took a little bit longer, but finally he started doing the mating dance with the male pigeon. Took the male pigeon out, put a decoy in. And it's progressively things less and less and less like a pigeon until finally they got this round rubber ball. And each time it would take him a little bit longer, but finally he ended up, you know, doing the mating dance with the rubber ball. So they took the rubber ball out and said, okay, what if there's nothing in the box? What is he going to do? And he finally focused on the corner of the box. And so, you know, the lesson you learn from this is that our capacity for certain reactions is pretty constant. And if we can't find, you know, a Western reason for anxiety, we'll find a Thai reason for anxiety. Indian reason for anxiety. And it can get pretty severe. Yes.
Is there any relationship or benefit to the application of like the not self concept to something like anxiety? The anxiety is not me.
Well, that's why I bring in the image of the committee. It's like I can recognize this as a voice in the mind, but I don't have to say it again as the only voice in there. That's an application actually of not self. But it's also recognizing that the voice is here in my mind. But the question of where it's coming from and whether I should believe it, whether I should identify with it, can then put that aside. So I'm stepping back from that.